Well, we're 98-0248 CR State v. Strong. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will not be participating. Mr. Scherr, Assistant State Public Defender representing Mr. Strong.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jackie Scherr, Assistant State Public Defender representing the defendant appellant in this case, William Strong. This court in State v. Sullivan established a framework for analysis of other acts of evidence, which included purpose, relevance, and whether the prejudicial effect, a third prong, overcomes the probative value of the evidence. In that third prong, unfair prejudice results when proffered evidence has a tendency to influence the outcome by improper means, or it appeals to a jury's sympathy, arouses a sense of horror, or instinct to punish, or otherwise causes a jury to base its decision on matters not consistent with established propositions in the case. In this case, there is no dispute as to the purpose of the evidence fitting a recognized category. The defendant was charged with a first-degree reckless homicide of a 22-month-old child, Kelly Witts, in Wausau in 1995. The state sought to introduce evidence of a prior incident in 1983 involving a child in Milwaukee who was 16 months old to establish that this was probative evidence for purposes of knowledge and absence of accident.
Knowledge of what?
The claim was that he would have been aware of what shaking could involve. The effects of shaking. Yes, sir. Now, there's some problems with the probative value of knowledge in this case, because in 1983...
Let me go back.
Yes, sir.
Why is that relevant at all? I mean, that wasn't even an issue, was it? The defendant had not put that into issue.
No, the state had put this in issue, Your Honor, by a pretrial motion, alleging that this prior incident was relevant for purposes of knowledge and absence of accident.
No, I'm not making myself clear. I look at this case, and this is something obviously that I'm going to be asking Mr. Lumsden, given time to think about it. And I say, you know, he didn't take the stand, did he?
No, he did not.
So all that they had at the point where the state tried to put in this evidence was his statements to the police and to the nurses or whatever that the baby had fallen. I don't know if he actually denied that he had shaken the baby, but in any event, shaking did not come up in any of his statements. He was not disputing the fact. I mean, he was disputing the fact of shaking. He was not disputing the consequences of shaking. And it seems to me that if you're putting it in for the purpose of showing the consequences of shaking, that wasn't even in dispute at this point.
Yes, Your Honor, the state...
So why is it relevant?
First of all, it has limited relevance, if any, for that purpose. It's important to note, to clarify, that when he gave a statement, and I assume you're referring to a statement to the police officer from the Wausau area, mm-hmm. He did indicate in that statement that he had shaken the child to try to rouse it. There really wasn't a great deal of discussion about that, but that was a factor that was involved in the case. It's our position that, in fact, the knowledge or awareness that he would have had based upon a 1983 incident, which was ruled an accident and in which there had been a police investigation in 1995, did not involve the evidence the state adduced to trial. There's no showing of why he would have been aware that any actions on his part would have involved in the earlier case would have had a bearing on the later case. So also, we have an objective standard under existing law in terms of first-degree reckless, basically a reasonable person test. Now, the state has pointed out in its brief that the jury instructions talk about an awareness of risk, and there would be possibly a subjective component of limited importance here. But the real issue was that, in fact, there was no necessity to introduce any of this evidence with regard to knowledge. The state at trial, there was a very extensive trial in this case of almost 3 weeks that involved a lot of expert testimony, and the state produced evidence from Dr. Robert Huntington and Dr. John Neal, among others, which indicated that the force that was used in the Witz case, in the Wassa case, would have been equivalent to a fall from a second-story building. There was absolutely no need to try this case based upon what occurred in 1983 in Milwaukee, which was an uncharged case. Now, it's particularly important here that the state, I think the court should also be aware that the state was trying to introduce this evidence for purposes of absence of accident. And obviously, under this court's Sullivan decision, the court described criminal intent is what absence of accident negates. In that case, it dealt with a battery case and verbal abuse, and cited a number of other cases which were intent cases, and used the famous Hunter example from Professor Wigmore, whereby if somebody shoots a gun at a person in the woods once or more than once, there's a certain probative value as to deliberateness after you get to the third attempt, say. But in this case, we were talking about something which was not a specific intent crime. You're also talking about something which is basically propensity evidence. This is evidence which, what Witte talked about, he did it once, therefore he must have done it again, or he failed to be punished in the first instance, and therefore he would be subject to punishment in this context. We have a situation here where this was not, there was no claim, for instance, that this was a planned situation. There's no claim that William Strong was a person who had in mind taking up with women who had young children, getting involved with them, and somehow then killing these children. That was not an issue in the case. It was not a claim. It was not a theory. And of course, where you have a common scheme or plan, you have a situation where the similarities of evidence are more important. But in this particular case, we had a situation where the absence of accident theory was of limited probative value. Now, there is some probative value potentially under the theory of the Bustamante case from the Court of Appeals, where the court had dealt with a 1978 second-degree murder case and a separate evidence that the defendant had abused another child. And in that case, the issue of unfair prejudice was not determined. And in fact, the fall from a crib and whether the doctrine of chances applied wasn't determined. It did reach the issue about and did allow absence of accident evidence in the forerunner of the present first-degree reckless in a case which involved a defendant's involvement in the so-called accident in that case. However, to the extent there is any limited probative value to the kind of evidence that was involved here, it's our position it doesn't matter. It was totally overwhelmed by the prejudice.
Okay, counsel. I apologize for interrupting, and I don't mean to deter you from answering the relevance question, but it seemed to me as part of your brief, you discussed this, quote, mini-trial. This is on the Costigan case that Justice Babbage is asking about.
Yes.
You seem to take issue, and I'm just trying to go back to my days when I was a trial judge, and you had a similar, you know, other acts. Of course, the law has changed a little bit, but we're talking about Sullivan. And you seem to say that, well, there was too much came in, and that's why it was its probativeness was outweighed by its prejudicial value. That you seem to say, and I'm wondering how this would come in. The state wanted to show what happened in 83. Could they have done it in another way other than devoting 2.5 days of trial and then ending up with a instruction from the judge which went back to the jury actually making a decision, not in beyond a reasonable doubt, but at least using the to a reasonable certainty by the greater weight of the credible evidence what happened to this first, you know, the 16-month-old child. The question is, do you take issue with the way it came in?
Yes.
You've seen it.
Yes, sir.
Now, how else could the judge have done this? How would he have done this?
Well, we have to go back. First of all, Your Honor, what the defense position was the evidence was overwhelmingly prejudicial and should not have come in.
Yeah, I understand that.
And to the the judge tried here. He initially, at the beginning of trial, cautioned the jury they should only use this evidence for purposes of knowledge. Tried to limit it.
In absence of accident.
Yeah. Well, the absence of accident was not part of his original cautionary instruction at the beginning of trial. What happened at the end of trial was he gave an instruction, and the conference reveals that he was trying to limit the evidence because he was concerned about the receipt of propensity evidence, particularly absence of accident, but then gave an instruction which was confusing. It said you're to receive it only for the purpose of knowledge, and then and absence of accident. So it potentially would come in for the precise purpose under this confusing instruction, or a jury could understand it to be for a purpose beyond what he had envisioned. And the question is this evidence so overwhelming that it can be admitted? Certainly it would be mitigated or reduced to the extent that you did not have a mini trial with regard to the evidence. If there was reference to a police report or a physician's report, to the extent that there was some probative value, it seems to me that what you could do that, as is normally done in a criminal trial, you have the receipt of some evidence. It's a report or a particular piece of evidence. But this was particularly significant here because what we had is the jury in this case, first of all, had to, at the end of the trial, it had to make a decision. And I think obviously the first thing that would have happened when it got in the jury room was whether this individual killed Patrick Costigan to a preponderance of the evidence. You would have to focus on that, deal with that, dwell with that evidence. And in fact, there would be, under those circumstances, there could be no meaningful balance. But I think we have to go back and look at the dimensions of the prejudice just in terms of this mini trial and in terms of how it came to be. Because after Judge Howard in the trial court had cautioned to try to limit the use of this evidence, and it's important that the defense made a continuing objection, objected to the cautionary instruction, and essentially took the point or claimed that, in fact, this was the type of evidence which could be improperly used for propensity. The judge recognized this. He was concerned about it. The prosecutor then engaged in a opening statement in this, devoting approximately 11 pages of their argument comparing the 1983 Milwaukee case or intertwining it with the 1995 Wausau case. And it's my position, Your Honor, that in this particular situation, this is one of the kinds of concepts that the court cautioned about in Sullivan and saying, you have to be very careful with the use of this evidence. Because, excuse me.
How could the district attorney have done a better job on the third prong to avoid prejudice?
My position, Your Honor, is that the district attorney, to avoid prejudice, could have done a better job by simply relying, not introducing this evidence, or simply this volume of evidence, but essentially the evidence at all, and relying on the evidence that was produced at trial, trying this based on the Witz case in 1995. There were, I believe, in that case, were something like 57 witnesses in the trial of the case. There was a great deal of evidence concerning the nature of the medical problems this child suffered, whether it was a cascade of injuries and brain swelling, and it was due to some kind of medical failures on the part of the hospital personnel. It was due to a lack of diligence on the part of Mr. Strong in getting the child to the hospital more quickly, or whether it was, in fact, attributable to a fall from a crib or a so-called shortfall, or attributable to a shake or slam type injury. There was a tremendous amount of evidence from which the jury could have fairly determined, based on the facts of the case, whether, in fact, Mr. Strong was guilty of any crime whatsoever. But what happened is the introduction of this evidence, particularly in the form and the nature that it came in at trial with regard to a trial, and a trial within a trial with regard to a finding, focused the attention of the jury on this evidence to an extent where it's our position it was so prejudicial that the defendant could not and did not get a fair trial.
Mr. Scherer, in the state's brief, and maybe in yours too, I can't remember, there's reference to the Jensen case, which is up here.
Yes.
In the Jensen case, as I remember it, the issue was whether or not there's an objective standard in this statute or a subjective standard.
That's correct.
And if there is a subjective standard, I assume that the defendant's knowledge of the risk of shaking a baby and what kind of damage can be rendered to a child of this age or within another year of it, it would be relevant evidence. I mean, I'm just making that as an assumption, because it would go to the defendant's, his subjective knowledge and awareness. It would also maybe accident versus intent here is relevant. I'm not so sure about that for the moment. That's the gun issue. But if, as in the Jensen Court of Appeals, the standard is objective, then this particular defendant's knowledge about the shaking child syndrome and this particular defendant's experience with it is irrelevant, I think, for the moment. I think that seems to me that's what you should be pressing on.
Well, Your Honor, this is what we're trying to say in this case. In other words, to the extent that there's any probative value to this evidence, it would be very limited under the standard. Mr. Lunston in his brief has cited the jury instruction, which talks about awareness. So there's an argument, at any rate, that there would be a subjective component to an objective standard, whatever that...
Is that what Jensen says in the Court of Appeals case?
Jensen basically, as I understand it, applied an objective standard consistent with Wiesow and consistent with Edmonds. But
Well, I think you have to separate out the aggravating factor of utter disregard for life from the mens rea of this crime, which is criminal recklessness. And the mens rea of this crime being criminal recklessness, it requires not only the proof that the defendant possessed or acted with criminal recklessness, but also that he had awareness that his conduct created the risk that criminal recklessness involves, right? That's completely separate from the aggravating factor of utter disregard for life, which gets this from a second degree to a first degree.
Right. Under ordinary recklessness, there is some requirement for awareness.
Right. But, and you're conceding that, and you're conceding the relevance of this evidence to
I'm
that.
I'm conceding it has very limited relevance, and it, which is and claiming that it's overwhelmed by the prejudice in this case.
And what's the limited relevance?
To the extent that the objective test, which is a reasonable person test, under the jury instruction, they're to look at a defendant's awareness as what a reasonable person would know, it seems to me that there could be some limited relevance.
Mr. Sayre,
but it is an objective test.
It is absolutely an objective test.
If I'd been trying this case, if I'd been the defense lawyer, and I put my client on the stand, and I said, do you know what the effect of shaking a baby is? And he says, I sure do. You can kill the baby. Would then, if the state tried to put in this evidence, would it be relevant? Because the defendant is conceding that he has knowledge. He says, I didn't shake the baby.
No, it would not.
That's the point that I was trying to make happen.
That's absolutely... I'm sorry, I didn't understand
you. Oh, okay.
I agree with that, Charlie. I want to point out a couple of things just so, because I think it's very important in terms of the dimension of the prejudice in this particular case. First of all, this was the kind of a situation where there's an affidavit from the defense lawyer, Robert Penegar, at page 72 of the record in this case with regard to the defendant potentially facing charges and the understanding that he would. And also the jury instruction given at the end of the case talked about a situation where there may be evidence that the defendant would be charged. So he was not in a position to testify. He was not in a position without waiving his rights to self-incrimination to deal with the Costigan case in terms of this volume of evidence. And it's our position that this was part of the dimension of prejudice was fundamentally unfair. Moreover, in terms of the closing argument in this case, there was a reference, approximately 47 pages of the record, in the closing, from 139.70, or 37 pages to 107, talking about the two cases. It's very clear that the focus of the trial and a major component of the trial was the Milwaukee incident. And under these circumstances, what's really happening here is there is no meaningful way under these circumstances to balance. What the third prong of Sullivan requires is a balancing. What we have is overwhelming propensity evidence. The person did this before, he's going to do it again. We have a continuing objection, it simply comes in, and then it's allowed to go to the jury for finding he killed another child by a shaken baby, and therefore that it was admissible in this case. The well was totally poisoned. And if this court adopts the rationale that has been previously adopted below, there will be no meaningful balance in these types of cases. I think it is important to note and distinguish that the cautionary instruction or the jury instruction in this case did tell the jurors not to consider this for purposes of character. However, I think that it's analogous to a situation like in the Bruton case in the United States Supreme Court, which we referred to in the brief. And in that case, you had a situation where the co-defendants were being tried in a joint trial, and they admitted a confession of the co-defendant against the co-defendant, and essentially told the jury, you can only consider this as to the co-defendant, not against this defendant. He said, essentially, that it was a mental impossibility to do this. I think it would be extremely hard for the jury in this case. And this is one of the factors the court had talked about in Sullivan if it did reach the third prong. They would have to look at the cautionary instructions because they can sometimes or can be effective and are a factor. But it's our position in this case that what the jury was being asked to do was to consider evidence which was so overwhelmingly prejudicial and so overwhelmingly probative of propensity that they could not realistically do it. And we think that the defendant did not receive a fair trial in this case, and we ask that the case be reversed. I do wish to mention briefly, I'm in the yellow light, I think I'm just about out of time. The state has invited, there's another issue about objective ingrained bias in this case, and the state has invited this court to apply the Martinez-Salazar rationale of the United States Supreme Court. I would ask that this court not do that. Martinez-Salazar relied on the rationale of Ross versus Oklahoma. This court in Ramos and Barron had this issue before it, prior to Martinez-Salazar. Oklahoma law requires use of a strike to get rid of a biased juror. Wisconsin law does not. The court considered those policy reasons. I believe it settled the fact that the United States Supreme Court has adopted the Ross position, Oklahoma position, for purposes of federal courts. It does not mean we should do so. It's not binding, and I submit that this is a settled matter, which ask the court to decline that invitation. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Lunson, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
Chief Justice, member of the court. Well, I thought you might get through the whole start of that argument without a reference to Ramos, and that I'd have to be the first one to bring it up. I think I will start with Ramos because there's a lot to talk about with the other acts evidence. And I think ultimately you'll see that this is a mainstream other acts case. If you're not persuaded of it yet, I hope you will be. But there's so much to talk about there that I'd like to start with Ramos, hopefully dispose of it somewhat quickly, and then move on to the other acts evidence.
Did you change your position since you argued Ramos?
No, I have not. You can imagine how happy I was in January when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled. Of course, this is an opportunity for you to rid yourself of me on this issue.
That's a positive spin.
Of course, what happened here is the Ramos situation. Mr. Strong wanted a juror removed for cause. The judge said no, and Mr. Strong thinks that was wrong. He used one of his peremptory strikes to remove that juror. So Mrs. Evenson, who you can read about in the transcripts, didn't sit. And another thing I'll just put to the side, I'm not going to talk about Mrs. Evenson. This transcript speaks for itself. If you read through the voir dire of this juror, I think you'll quickly agree that she was, if not a perfect juror, pretty close to it. She was open-minded on all these topics and said so. But the question is, do you even need to get to that issue? Because before Ramos, if you had had this fact situation in front of you, you would not have needed to even get to it. Before Ramos, other courts, at least the Court of Appeals, and I contend this court, would have said, well, even if the judge erred, what happened here is a peremptory strike removed that juror. End of question. The judge's error was harmless. So do you even need to look at that transcript? Okay, so the reason I'm saying that you should reconsider is Martinez-Salazar. I agree with only about one thing that Mr. Shire said about Martinez-Salazar, and that's that it's not binding on this court. Back when I argued Ramos, I tried to make clear that this is not a constitutional issue. There's no constitutional principle that dictates that you come down on one side or the other. And it's also not a statutory case. That is, there's no statutory language to look to in order to determine the nature of peremptory strikes and whether this kind of use of a peremptory strike is a proper use. What we have here is a common law question. And in this common law matter, this court is free to deviate from the United States Supreme Court. The question is, should you, why would you, or in this case, unfortunately in this case, the, you know, Martinez-Salazar, the U.S. Supreme Court got around to directly addressing this after you did. But what's notable about the Ramos decision is how heavily you relied on U.S. Supreme Court precedent to glean, you know, the nature of peremptory strikes. The majority decision in this court looked to Ross v. Oklahoma for, not directly for its ruling in that case on Oklahoma law, but for its pronouncements on the general nature of peremptory strikes. And for the same reason, it looked to Swain v. Alabama. You look to federal court of appeals cases. Justice Abrahamson's concurring opinion, likewise, looked to federal law for guidance. And not unreasonably, you know, there are a lot of broad pronouncements in federal law about the importance of peremptory strikes. But what I argued then and what I argue today is that, and what was adopted by the United States Supreme Court, is that they acknowledge that these are important, but that those other cases didn't really address or square what we're talking about here today. And that's that is one of the many purposes of peremptory strikes, the timely correction of trial court error. And what I'm suggesting, and you know, what this U.S. Supreme Court has held, is that one of the reasons, and historically this is how it has worked, that one of the reasons you have peremptory strikes is so that if a trial judge does err, does make an unreasonable ruling on a strike for cause, it can be fixed right away. It's a completely rational process. The error is made, the defendant, we do not have to proceed with a meaningless trial. The defendant or the state can exercise a peremptory strike to correct the error. And then you proceed with an impartial jury. It is one of the ways you get an impartial jury. At its core, it's a very simple holding in that respect. And I think it makes very good sense. I don't think that there's any reason to depart from federal law in this respect. I mean, we've inherited peremptory strikes from common law. They are not something that was invented by this court. They're something that are common to many states and fairly uniformly defined. I don't know what all the other state courts have done with them. It'll be interesting to see how the other state courts respond to Martinez-Salazar. You'll be one of the first to have that opportunity. But I think what you find in Martinez-Salazar is just a common sense view of how a system should work. And in the case of Ramos, the state did retry that case. Ramos was convicted, but was it necessary? I contend no. I contend that Mr. Ramos probably wasn't even aware of what happened during trial. The notion that, you know, if your attorney objects for cause and the judge says, no, I don't think so, that juror looked pretty good to me, and the defendant, suppose for argument's sake, the defendant is sitting there thinking, boy, that's not fair, and his attorney leans over and says, don't worry about it, we have peremptory strikes, we're going to get rid of that juror. The defendants, you know, and things go on. And that's the way it should work. I'm going to say just a real quick word about the Gesch rule, because it has muddied the waters. Wisconsin has, by one of your decisions, a rule on what happens when a defendant chooses not to exercise a peremptory strike. When a defendant decides, I think the judge made a mistake, and I'm not going to correct it here because I think I might want to complain about that on appeal, this court has held that that's an option for a defendant. If he chooses not to remove that juror, not to use a peremptory strike, then they preserve that issue for appeal. Now, the reason that that is important here is that in Ramos, I think this court thought that the argument I was making was inconsistent with this state's Gesch rule, that what I was proposing was inconsistent, that the harmless error approach was inconsistent with Gesch. And And I think if nothing else, Martinez-Salazar puts that to rest, because in the same decision that the U.S. Supreme Court adopted harmless error, they also adopted your Gesch rule. So what we have is those two coexisting, not only, you know, in the court's opinions, but in the same opinion. I'm not going to get into the technicalities of why that is possible, but I want to draw your attention to it, because it was one of the legs of the Ramos decision.
So, why do you think this other act's evidence, what do you think the other act's evidence here is relevant to what consequential element or fact that had to be proved?
Well, the state had the burden of proving awareness of risk and utter disregard.
And that's subjective rather than objective test?
Well, there's two, there are two separate approaches for the two elements. Awareness, element two, awareness of risk, is by its terms subjective. You have to prove the defendant's subjective awareness of the risk. So, to some degree, the objective, subjective argument that the defendant makes is just a red herring, because under element two, I think he admits that it's a subjective test, and that Mr. Strong's awareness of the risk was an element, was subjective, and something the state needed to prove.
If Mr. Strong, prior to trial, through his attorney, indicated that his defense was not that, was that he didn't shake the baby, but he knows full well the effects of shaking a baby, would this evidence have been relevant then?
The evidence certainly would have been relevant. I think are you wondering whether the defendant could have stipulated away the issue?
Yeah.
He offered to stipulate to it?
Yeah, and it's sort of like, I wasn't there, defend. What case was it that we had? I don't know, we had some kind of case as to what was in the issue here. I'm concerned about what was an issue in this case, because at the time this evidence was put in, as far as I can tell from the record, the only thing that Strong had said was that the baby fell out of the crib. In other words, and implicit within that statement is, I didn't shake her.
Well, as this case did come in, I mean, putting your hypothetical aside, mm-hmm. if he had offered to stipulate, as the case did come in, I think there's no doubt that it was relevant, that he hadn't admitted that... we don't know what Strong's position would have ultimately been. What the prosecutor knew going into trial was that the prosecutor had to prove, affirmatively prove, that Mr. Strong had an awareness of the risk that he created.
By shaking the baby?
Yes. By shaking, and this is a shake and a slam case, there's a combination of the two. Mr. Shire talked about one witness testifying that the injury was consistent with a 10-story fall.
So the prosecutor had to prove here that, number one, that Strong shook the baby, and number two, that Strong had an awareness that shaking the baby could cause great bodily harm or death.
The expert testimony was more complicated than that, and that's what I was trying to get at. The notion that this is a shake and a slam case, mm-hmm. and it's the interaction of these two, there were some small external injuries on the child's head, indicating that the child had not only been shaken, but it also, the head had hit something. Of course, Mr. Strong's theory was it hit the toy. And the state's theory was it was a combination of the two. Now, to address your question, the state had to prove that if they were able to show that Mr. Strong shook and the child also struck their head in the course of that, that if he did that, the state didn't only have to show that Strong knew that that was a danger, that he could have injured the child. It's the magnitude of the risk. He had to show that he was creating a danger of great bodily harm or death. And so, it's sort of easy to think about this violent shaking and slamming against the wall in very exaggerated terms and say, well, of course, they would have known. But the reality here is it's more subtle. The degree of shaking is something that's it's just not as clear. It's when you have the combination of the shaking and the throwing against the wall, it is important. A juror could have sat there and said, well, I don't know if he really understood what he was doing. But he wasn't experienced with children, who knows what.
Hadn't Strong, in fact, denied that he even shook the baby?
Not that I'm aware of. I think it's implicit. Mm-hmm. As Mr. Scharf points out, he didn't deny shaking the baby, so there's that ambiguity in the record. I mean, he does admit to shaking the child to try to rouse the child. And
I have no problem with this evidence with respect to what we're talking about. I'm putting aside the propensity. I have no problem with this evidence if Strong himself had said, sure, I shook the baby, but I had no knowledge that shaking that baby was going to cause any harm. Then clearly this evidence is relevant on that. But that's not the facts of this case.
Well, it would be nice if it worked that way. I would love it if you'd create a system of justice where we got to know ahead of time what the defense would be, mm-hmm. so that we could tailor our proof to it.
Well, the not guilty puts you to proof of everything.
Yes.
So that's what the state has to do?
Yes. And in this case, that included not only awareness of risk, but a showing of utter disregard for human life. We had to show this very high level of first-degree reckless conduct causing homicide.
Is that known as the fourth element? Is that what your problem is, or is it the second element in this case?
I'm not sure what you mean by the fourth element. The elements 2 and 3, awareness of risk and utter disregard, are the two that are appropriate.
Okay, and in the awareness of risk, that's subjective?
Yes.
And the utter disregard?
I agree with Mr. Shire, it's objective.
Okay. So now, to which one of these does this evidence go?
To both.
Well, if it's objective, why do you need the subjective, what this defendant thought?
Because when you're looking at the objective standard, you have to have context for it. I hope my explosive powder example shed some light on it. If a defendant is charged with using explosive powder for reckless conduct and showing utter disregard, the state might have a little problem there because on its face it's just a pile of powder. And it'd be helpful for the state to show that the defendant had experience with that powder and knew that it could cause a large explosion and damage and seriously harm a person. So proof that the defendant had specific knowledge of what are the dangerous properties of explosive powder is directly relevant to showing that his conduct showed utter disregard for human life. Likewise here, I mean, just to talk about this case directly, in order to show utter disregard for human life, the state had to show that Strong essentially understood what he was doing. It's not simply, let me correct myself. We didn't have to show that he understood what he was doing for utter disregard, but it helps to show. If you know that he is aware of the seriousness of his conduct, then that helps you understand that his conduct was with utter disregard.
Mr. Lundstrom, my question would be the same as I asked opposing counsel on the methodology of the other acts. In this case, and I know this is, and perhaps you could, and you addressed some of this in your brief, but here we had a 19-day trial, about 2.5-3 days committed to this other act's evidence where experts were called in, and then the jury got an instruction. Now, I found that to be maybe unusual, perhaps that you can correct me, but where the jury got this instruction from the judge who instructed them as to the evidence concerning Costigan's death, and then I won't read the instruction, but the jury was asked, you can use this as far as awareness of risk, knowledge, and then the evidence presented by the state must satisfy you to a reasonable certainty by a greater weight of the credible evidence that Patrick Costigan died of the shaken baby syndrome through acts committed by William Strong. It just seems to me you're going through the Sullivan test. You've got the three things you talked about, purpose, relevance. There was a concession, well, maybe something was relevant, but what about that too much was proven in this case, that the jury had this first death before it, and then getting away from propensity, at least this was in their mind when they went to the case of the Woods baby. In other words, you had a great deal of this, I won't say an advisory jury opinion, but at least the jury had to come up and make these decisions that normally you might have had, well, there is a record, this happened in 1983, that here's a police record, even though it may have been an accident, if you know someone, the coroner, no, the doctor came in and basically changed his testimony. A, in 83, he said it was an accident. In 95, he said it was not. You know, he knew more about the shaken baby syndrome. My question is just the methodology of that proof as having an effect on that jury.
Well, I understand two parts of your question. Right. One has to do with the state's burden of proof in the notion of other acts evidence. To what level do they have to prove the other acts? And then the second, I think, goes to did the state put on too much evidence? Well, on the too much evidence part, that question was put to Mr. Shire, I think, three times, and each time he had no suggestion for you as to how the state could have put on less evidence with the same probative value. Again, he wasn't conceding the other act's evidence. He wasn't conceding that it was true. The state had to prove it. And I think that they were very prudent in how they went about that. There weren't any excess witnesses. And if you look at it in proportion to the charged crime, it was very proportional. It's 2.5 days out of a 3-week trial.
Let me ask a question, rephrasing Justice Wilcox's question. I thought I understood Mr. Shire to say that the first thing the jury did when they came back to the jury room was basically to decide whether this defendant, Mr. Strong, had killed a child, 12 years earlier, before they could apply what they had heard to this case.
Yes.
Isn't there some pretty serious prejudice in that? I mean, please address that for me.
It's exactly... I believe the U.S. Supreme Court case on this topic is Huddleston. I'm not positive about it. But, you know, the notion is that it's not fair for the state to ask a jury to use something against the defendant if the state hasn't shown that it occurred. So part of the state's burden, if they're going to present other acts evidence, is to show that it's true. Because typically the defendant is not admitting to anything. So the state has its burden of proof, and the question arose is, does the state have to prove the other acts evidence to the same degree beyond a reasonable doubt, or is it because it is not the charged crime, is a lower level of proof acceptable, and the court held that a lower level of proof is acceptable, that because this is an evidentiary issue and an admissibility sort of question, a lower standard is acceptable in this, is appropriate in this situation. So the notion that a jury has to decide whether or not the other act's evidence occurred is normal. It's how it normally works with other act's evidence. I mean, you seldom see a situation where a jury is instructed to accept the fact of other act's evidence. The prosecutor normally has to prove it.
Did the defendant have an opportunity to call witnesses in this mini trial?
Certainly. The defendant could have mounted exactly the same defense to the other acts evidence that he mounted to the charged crimes.
And could the defendant have taken the stand and limited his cross-examination, and the plaintiff, the prosecutor, be limited in the cross-examination solely as to the Cordigan offense and not to the Wirtz offense?
Could he have limited his testimony to the other acts offense?
What if the defendant says to his lawyer, I want to take the stand, I wasn't even there. I got an alibi, I can't prove it, but I wasn't there. What happens if he goes on the stand and says, I wasn't there, I didn't do it? How broad a range can the cross-examination be?
First, I want to make sure I understand your question. So you're sort of doing the opposite of what Mr. Schar is arguing.
Yes.
You're saying if he just wants to testify about the other acts evidence.
Right.
Well, that's the question you hope for in the moot court, and so that you're ready for it when you get it.
Well, the reasonable question is whether or not this is like an in limine motion that has to be settled out before. You would get to the main event, and it's like the suppression of a confession where the defendant takes the stand but doesn't deal with the substance of this crime, which leads me to the issue that, and I didn't get a chance to look at it, but other acts evidence just takes up pages of Weinstein and Berger on evidence. It takes up Wigmore and other texts. Do they have any suggestions for how to handle this? Where it's one thing if you have a conviction, then it's easy, right? But when you don't have a conviction, then this is the first case that I can remember in this court where you've got this kind of trial within a trial. You've got a collateral issue, that's what it's usually called, that has taken up so much time and so much energy. Ordinarily, the fight is only about on the other acts evidence, are they similar enough? So, is there anything in the text that suggests a better way of doing this?
No, I don't believe so. I believe the proper way is to have a mini-trial, if you want to call it that, on the other acts evidence. I question whether the situation with a conviction is the appropriate way to do it. I'm not sure...
The other act says it doesn't have to be a conviction.
Right.
So I recognize that. But even when there is no conviction in prior cases, there's not been a dispute on the guilty aspect of these other acts. They usually go off on, are they similar enough, with the assumption being made that the defendant did it.
Well, in the conviction situation, I think usually the significance of the conviction is the defendant probably isn't contesting the other act's evidence, and he has an interest in sort of limiting how it gets introduced.
Well, it's not introduced at all because it's not similar enough.
Pardon me?
Well, not introduced at all because it's not similar enough.
Well, if he is challenging it.
Right.
But, I mean, as to how if the evidence is ruled admissible, as to how it comes in, I think a lot of times you have cases where convictions are used, but I think that's a function of the fact that the defendant isn't really contesting it and would just like to have it done as quickly as possible. Suppose the defendant says, well, I was wrongly convicted. And if you tell the jury I was convicted, that's tantamount to instructing them on the fact that I did this prior other act.
So
I think
you would
the state,
allow a mini trial on that.
Well, I think the state has the burden under the structure that is in place to prove the other act's evidence by a preponderance, but to prove it nonetheless. So I don't know that it's ever been litigated whether using a conviction is an appropriate manner of proof. But it's just one way to prove it. But I think that the sampling of cases this court has received might be a bit skewed then, because I've seen many cases where the other act's evidence itself was contested, and the other act's witnesses were cross-examined, and their credibility was impeached.
Sure.
I think that happens frequently.
And we've seen them where the prior victim of the sexual offense says, yeah, he did it. whether or not there was a conviction, and she's on the stand, but not to the degree of this number of witnesses, and so significantly contested, and this number of days spent on it. But it may be that it's just skewed, and it may be that I'm not remembering it correctly.
I mean, this is the case where if you sit and read through this entire mammoth trial transcript, the other act's evidence takes perspective. I mean, the state can't pick. I mean, I suppose the state would have loved it if it could have put on the other act's evidence and three witnesses with the same probative force. That would have been nice. We would have liked that. But the reality is that we couldn't do it. There wasn't a way to give it the same probative value and only use three witnesses.
What about my problem?
I wasn't stalling on that. I sidetracked. Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, it's not been briefed at all. I hesitate to just stick my neck out on an issue that's something that's not an issue in this case. My best guess is that when the defendant takes the witness stand, he then, even for that purpose, would waive, under Neely and Haskins, he'd waive any objection to cross-examination on any topic reasonably related to the charged offense. So, I think applying the Neely Haskins analysis, you almost would have to crank out the result that he would open himself up to cross-examination on the charged crime.
Now, what about, it seems to me, that again, that this is, your comparison is to motion and limine. It seems to me that initially the trial judge has to make a decision to allow in the testimony. That initially there has to be a kind of, how close is it in terms of time, nature, etc., and how much you're going to let in. And initially this would be a judge's decision. Did that happen here?
Yes, it did. And there was a balancing. There was extensive briefing in this case pre-trial.
And did the judge hear any of the witnesses or... Did the defendant take the stand at that time?
No, I don't think, and it wouldn't be the proper role for the judge to assess credibility or whether the state's, you know, case was believable. It would be the notion of, well, if you succeed in proving this, you know, what probative value does it have? And then doing the traditional Sullivan analysis.
Okay, so it was not a testimonial preliminary review of this. It was on the paper.
Yes,
effect.
That's correct. Well, on this topic, I've got so many things to talk about that I won't get to, but is the notion of, he has a very novel prejudice claim that he's raising, and that's the notion that when you're balancing prejudice and, I have run out of time.
You may complete that thought.
Thank you. And I'm going to try to figure out the shortest way to say it then. He's suggesting a completely new category of other acts prejudice, completely new. And he is suggesting that a defendant faced with other acts evidence could, apart from the Sullivan analysis as it stands now, could defeat admission by simply saying, well, you know, I wanted to testify about the charged crime, but if you put in the other acts evidence, that chills me. I don't want to testify if the other acts evidence comes in. And based on that bald assertion, which is all we have in this case, a judge says, well, his right to testify is huge, and we've got to, you know, and the prejudice is great if he's not allowed to testify, therefore I'm going to have to keep the other acts evidence out. And that is what his prejudice argument amounts to. And if this court buys into it, it will create a tremendous change in other acts evidence law. That's what I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Scherr.
Your Honor,
your 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Mr. Scherr, could I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
The gauntlet has been thrown down to you, Father. Mr. Lunson.
Yes.
He said, you have no way of getting the evidence in, assuming it could come in, better than what was done in this trial. What do you say to that?
Absolutely incorrect. This was perhaps the most prejudicial and inappropriate way to produce evidence of this type. First of all, if it were admissible at all, it would be a relative, the state has conceded it's an objective standard as to element three. So it would be a very limited probative value. You would not need 2.5 days of a trial to establish this evidence. What happens in terms of the presentation of witnesses, the opening, the closing, and the fact the defendant could not testify without opening himself up, if that's the case, presented an enormously prejudicial bit of evidence that denied him the opportunity to have a fair trial. It was propensity evidence, involved the death of a child. It's something that would arouse horror and passion and the kinds of things that unfair prejudice deal with. And the reality is, how do you deal with something like this in this type of a case? You either mitigate it to the extent possible and limit it to a reasonable amount, or you simply, as is appropriate here, exclude it altogether. It wasn't necessary. In this particular case, they had evidence in the case in chief, in the Wassa case. We mentioned before, like a fall from a two-story building, the state's witnesses, and this was controverted. The defense had a number of witnesses as well with different perspectives. But there was plenty of evidence from which a jury could reasonably infer knowledge in this case. There was simply no need to put any of this in. And rather than...
But are you saying that the basic process that was used, I mean, you don't agree that it should come in, but the basic process that was used was tainted simply by too many witnesses and too much time?
Your Honor, I'm saying that part of this is, yes, first of all, you have a situation where there's a question of whether it's relevant at all. If it is relevant, it comes in for a very limited purpose. In this particular case, evidence which had a very limited purpose in a case, if it comes in an overwhelming proportion, is what the prejudice dimension goes to the extent it had any relevance or was relevant, was totally overwhelmed by the prejudice.
But you're not arguing that there was something that could have been done to minimize the prejudicial effect and wasn't done, and therefore, it's there. Not your position. Your position is that under the circumstances of this case, it never should have been allowed in the first place, because in order to prove the witty, it was going to take a whole lot of witnesses and a whole lot of time, and that by its very nature is inherently prejudicial.
That's correct. However, to the extent, can I qualify that, Your Honor? In this particular case, if the state had a limited amount of evidence that it attempted to put in this particular case, it would have diminished the prejudice. Okay? My position is that what the state is essentially saying is that they need a mini trial of this nature to prove this kind of situation and prove something that has very limited, if any, relevance to this case, and that's exactly where the prejudice overwhelms to the extent that it could come in at all. It was overwhelmed. Now, if the state had chosen, or the prosecutor had chosen, to put in one witness or one report or something else, it may have satisfied any limited probative value that this evidence had. But what happened here is there was a trial within a trial and a finding based upon all of that evidence, which was essentially propensity evidence, which made it absolutely impossible for this defendant to get a fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sir. Thank you, Mr. Lundston. That concludes the hearing in 98-0248 J.P. Strong. The court is in recess until 1:45 p.m. Thank you.